Good morning and welcome to chapel this morning. We're glad that you're here. Today, we have the opportunity to hear about a most important topic, religious liberty. And there are several experts who have come to be with us today. Dr. Baker, our Dean of Instruction and Associate Professor of Political Science, will be introducing them to you today, but I encourage you to listen well. Let's go to the Lord in prayer. Lord God Almighty, you have made all the peoples of the earth for your glory, to serve you in freedom and in peace. Give to the people of our country a zeal for justice and the strength of forbearance, that we may use our liberty in accordance with your gracious will. Through Jesus Christ our Lord, who lives and reigns with you and the Holy Spirit, one God forever and ever. Amen. Dr. Baker.
Well, good morning and welcome to chapel. Greg Thornberry is off trying to make great dreams a reality in New York City. In fact, Dr. Thornberry did a chapel service for us early this semester. And you may remember that he tried to kind of rally you with a word that has gained some currency here on campus. In fact, his spirit is, you know, whispering in my ear a little bit. What was the word? Do you remember? Solidarity, right? You know, since I can't wear those skinny little English suits and all that stuff, you know, I'm not going to put on a big show. I'll look silly. But the word is solidarity. So I want to talk about that just a little bit. Now, two summers ago, you may remember that Dan Cathy spoke in an unguarded way to a reporter. And when asked his view on gay marriage, he responded clearly from his conviction that marriage only exists between a man and a woman. And we all remember what followed. It was probably the dominant news story for several days, maybe a few weeks. The mayors of major cities such as Boston and Chicago both ventured opinions that Chick-fil-A stores should not perhaps be welcome in those cities because of Cathy's opinion about marriage. Mike Huckabee, former governor of Arkansas, then called for a show of support for Chick-fil-A. And on a warm summer day, nearly the whole of American evangelicalism descended upon the stores and bought more biscuits, ice dreams, chicken strips, peach milkshakes, and even carrot raisin salad than the corporation could provide. Politicians, always sensitive to a display of mass demonstration, backed off. So it was sort of an uneasy truce. The controversy subsided, and Chick-fil-A has had no desire to continue that controversy. Now, I was surprised around that time to see a number of union students, students I knew, even a young lady who babysat my children, post to Facebook from a blog that kind of laid out why they were not going to Chick-fil-A, why they were not supporting the company. And they viewed supporting Chick-fil-A as some kind of an angry attack upon gay men and women. I think that perhaps the genesis of this session today lies in those reactions. There is a time and a place to argue about gay marriage. That's not the primary intent here. It may come up. But I think you should not see the mass support of Chick-fil-A as being mostly about marriage. It was primarily about freedom of conscience and religious liberty. I went to Chick-fil-A because I did not want to see the purveyors of the new sexual ethic find a way to hound a good family out of business or to force them to bend a knee to new sensibilities. And that brings us back to solidarity. Between gay marriage, the HHS mandate on contraception and abortifacients, and a number of other pressing issues, there will be many Christians and many Christian organizations under pressure to compromise their convictions. Whether you agree or disagree with an underlying policy, The question is, will you demonstrate solidarity with your brothers and sisters to protect their religious liberty and their freedom of conscience? Now, Chick-fil-A and Hobby Lobby get the headlines, but these things also affect ordinary individuals. For instance, what about Christian doctors? I know that early in my own marriage, my wife, we married while she was in medical school, and then she did a residency in Houston at Baylor College of Medicine. And she was punished because she refused to go to Planned Parenthood. She refused to go. They punished her, despite her sincere objections. What about Christian nurses and pharmacists, for whom these issues will become very real and already are? What about Christians who do things like take pictures of weddings or provide the flowers? With that, I'd like to introduce our guests. Now, first of all, over here on the left, we have Andrew Walker. Andrew T. Walker serves as Director of Policy Studies for the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, the denomination's entity tasked with addressing moral, social, and ethical issues. Prior to his position with the ERLC, he served as a policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation's DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society. Walker has had essays and reviews published in outlets such as the Louisville Courier-Journal, The City, The Weekly Standard, The Public Discourse, National Review Online, Christianity Today, The Gospel Coalition, and as a freelance writer for the Institute on Religion and Democracy. In 2013, the New York Times featured him as one of America's leading young advocates for traditional marriage. He is a graduate of Southwest Baptist University and received the Master of Divinity from the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. He is currently a THM student in Christian Ethics at Southern Seminary, focusing his studies on political ethics and church-state relations. He is married to Christian. They have one daughter, Caroline, and they reside in Franklin, Tennessee. Micah Watson, this tall gentleman here on the right, is Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the Center for Politics and Religion at Union University. He is a native of, as he describes it, the Great Golden State of California, where he completed his undergraduate degree at UC Davis and played a little ball. He completed his MA degree in Church-State Studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. He holds an MA and doctoral degree in politics from Princeton University. Dr. Watson has taught previously at Villanova University and at Princeton. And Dr. Watson is married to Julie Watson, and together they have four daughters and a son. I see a naming scheme here. Abigail, Anastasia, Annika, Alexandra, and John. Accompanied by their faithful dog, Jack. So they named their son and their dog with a J. Accompanied by their faithful dog, Jack, they make their home in Jackson, Tennessee. I'm touched by this inclusion of the family dog. For my part, I have a 17-year-old semi-incontinent cat who, true story, threw up in my shoes this morning. So I'm off to a good start. C. Ben Mitchell in the center here is the Graves Professor of Moral Philosophy at Union University in Tennessee and editor of Ethics and Medicine in International Journal of Bioethics. Prior to joining the Union faculty, he taught bioethics and contemporary culture for a decade at Trinity Graduate School in Deerfield, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago, where he was also director of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity from 2006 to 2008. He received his doctorate in philosophy with a concentration in medical ethics with honors from the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. In addition to his academic work, Mitchell also consults on matters of public policy and has given testimonies before policymaking groups, including the U.S. House of Representatives, the Institutes of Medicine, and the Illinois Senate. He has published in major news media, including the Washington Post, and is interviewed regularly on radio and television, having appeared on National Public Radio, Fox News, MSNBC, and others. Now, on to the questions. What we will do is I will ask these gentlemen a series of questions. My instruction to you is, you know, obviously speak pithily. I imagine none of you will dominate the session for the entire time. And feel free to respond to each other. You know, you need no help from me to do so. If you wish to interject, feel free to do that. I'd like to start with a question for Dr. Mitchell. Now, Dr. Mitchell, you, not all that long ago, gave testimony before Congress on the Health and Human Services mandate, which requires that employers provide insurance coverage for things including contraception and abortifacient products. First of all, and I'll have maybe a follow-up, what were you there to say about the mandate?
Well, I was specifically invited to be part of a panel that represented a number of different religious traditions. And so on my right was a Roman Catholic bishop, and on his left, between myself and the bishop, was the head of the Missouri Synod Lutheran denomination, and myself. On my left was a Jewish rabbi who was representing liberty concerns from a Jewish perspective, and then on his left was a colleague from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, Craig Mitchell. And we were specifically invited and asked to speak out of our religious tradition about the nature of religious liberty and liberty of conscience. I was delighted to be able to do that because I'm a Baptist, and Baptists have made historically a huge contribution to religious liberty. It's probably no secret to anyone, there's never been a Baptist state religion, and for good reason, because Baptists, out of a background of persecution and out of a background of dying for their faith, against state religion, sort of laid the foundation for religious liberty, at least from the 1600s on. So I was asked to speak specifically out of my religious context, out of my denominational background.
Okay, and it's very interesting. Probably a regrettable number of students get their news from The Daily Show, starring Jon Stewart. And interestingly, your testimony actually appeared on Jon Stewart's show, The Daily Show. He was utterly perplexed by some of your claims, including you. You stated that that infringements of religious liberty are very serious, so serious to be considered, I think you used Roger Williams' term, like a rape of the soul. Can you explain maybe, you know, why is he so perplexed by that? He's just completely unable to understand you.
Well, I think that's a very good question, and I can't answer for Jon Stewart. I don't know his mind, though most of what he thinks, I think he says. So I have a pretty good idea about what he's thinking. And of course, as you're suggesting, I mean, he really lit up on the quote from Roger Williams, who said that to coerce any individual to believe a certain way is the rape of the soul. And that's in scare quotes, the rape of the soul. And Stewart just went ballistic. Rape of the soul? Well, we should ask some women about rape, and let's talk about rape. And I think the reason he found that expression so abhorrent in his mind was simply because he disliked why we were there and what we were up to. Even though I think had he paid attention to the other things that I and my colleagues there said, we were defending his right to believe that we were crazy, just as much as we were wanting to protect our both free speech and religious liberty right to believe and say what we believe to be true.
That's a very good point. Thank you, Mr. Walker. You're coming to us from the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention. Recently, Russell Moore has been appointed the head of that commission. Previously, the academic dean, senior vice president at Southern Seminary. Now, at one time, the Democratic Party was seen as really probably the superior protector of religious liberty in the United States. It's interesting. During the time when I was engaging with religious liberty law firms when I was in law school, a lot of the people there would say, I'd rather have a Democratic appointee hear my case than a Republican appointee. And indeed, religious liberty at times has commanded wide support. In the early 1990s, when there was dismay over the Supreme Court Smith decision, which seemed to really undercut religious liberty, almost the whole of Congress could be moved to vote for the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. that situation does not pertain today. For whatever reason, religious liberty seems to be becoming kind of a one-party issue. Could you address why is that, and is Russell Moore going to be able to help with that?
Sure. So I think one of the problems right now we have in messaging on religious liberty and making a more compelling case is that we often think of religious liberty as simply this right to be pious, a right to have our own sectarian ethics, the right to kind of go off in our own corner and do our own thing. But we fail to realize that freedom of religion or religious freedom is really a function of conscience, and that conscience is a function of human dignity, and that whatever ethics or values that we think are corresponding to divine truth, that we have an obligation to act on those duties and obligations that spring from eternal truth or transcendent truth. But those are phrases right there that you notice I didn't just use in Christian terms. Those are terms that a Jewish individual or a Muslim individual would also employ as well. And I feel that we're not understanding that the freedom of religion is really a function of the freedom to believe. It's a freedom to have your conscience acknowledged as valid. It's a function of your humanity. And on a more practical level, I feel like the debates about the Ground Zero Mosque have put evangelical Christians in a really uncomfortable and often tragic position, because we're not willing to extend the religious liberty to others that we would want to extend to ourselves. Now, obviously, there are some cultural sensitivity issues involved in those mosque situations like at Ground Zero. But as Christians, and particularly as Baptists, we ought to be advocating for the right of any religion to set up where it can set up, because we don't want the government to dictate where Muslims can or cannot build, because the same logic and the same precedent would then say the government has a say in where Christians can or cannot build. So the encouraging thing to turn towards the election of Russell Moore as president of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission is that I feel like he gets this. He recognizes that religious freedom is under threat in America, but it's not under threat just as Christians. It's under threat if you're a Muslim, again, or if you're a Jewish individual. And not only that, too, that he recognizes that to be an advocate for religious liberty in our particular atmosphere today means that we have to display convictional kindness, which means, yes, we are going to disagree with Jewish individuals and Muslim individuals, but you also have to recognize that we have an obligation to lobby on their behalf, to believe what they want to believe. And so as we're coming back to this theme that Greg Thornberry is talking about with solidarity, I feel like that's a theme that is actually drawing together kind of a multi-faith front on religious liberty. No one's denying the differences that we believe, but we're all recognizing that with kind of this encroaching secularism in kind of elite sectors of culture, it's time that all individuals of faith band together and kind of confront and eventually really refute is what you call the new sexual orthodoxy.
Yep. Thank you. I have a question for you, Dr. Watson. And then after that, I have one I'd like to kind of pose to the three of you, because interestingly, when I asked the three of you for questions, all three of you suggested a version of this question. But first, Dr. Watson, one of the arguments against religious liberty, in fact, I think you maybe saw this played out in the Smith decision a little bit, is that a strong notion of religious liberty dissolves the force of law in a society. In other words, how can we make binding laws if we have to respect rights of conscience and action advanced by religious believers? What do we say to this objection?
Well, Dr. Baker, the first thing I have to do is tell you we also have a dog named Ripley. And if Ripley were to find out that she was left out of this event...
It's your dated bio. That's your fault.
Well, her conscience would be violated, and I need to protect that. So, for those of you who may not be aware of the Smith decision, in the early 90s, there were two Native Americans in Oregon who worked for the state, and they had been fired for ingesting peyote, which is a part of Native American religious rituals. And ironically, they worked for the state of Oregon's anti-drug program. And then when they had applied for unemployment benefits, they were denied because you can't get unemployment benefits if you're fired for using what the state sees as drugs. And the case worked its way down. We don't have to get into all the details of it. But one of the issues raised was if you can claim, well, I can do this because my religion tells me, one of the concerns you have is, well, what's the limit, right? My religion tells me I can act on my white supremacist views in various nefarious ways. And my religion tells me, and fill in the blank with, I can steal or I can do something, infant sacrifice. So one of the challenges then in any kind of pluralistic society is to conceive of a way of a robust space for religious practice, yet still having to have some stop, right? Some means of saying, well, yes, you can do this, but we as a society decide you can't do that. One example here would be with blood transfusions. Jehovah's Witnesses believe that to accept a blood transfusion violates the biblical prohibition of ingesting blood. And so they will refuse to have a blood transfusion if they're being faithful. And so we have this decision to make. Are we going to allow a Jehovah's Witness who is perhaps in the hospital, in the emergency room, dying, to die, or are we going to violate their belief and force them to have a blood transfusion? And in fact, what we have done, at least I believe most recently our position on this, most states, is we will let an adult die rather than violate their religious belief about blood transfusions. Now, the really tricky question, though, comes up, what if it's one of their kids? What if it's a six-year-old who we think has not had the opportunity yet to make that decision? And in those instances, we do actually choose to say, no, we're not going to respect the religious belief here. We're going to override that. So what this issue is where the rubber hits the road in terms of the practicality of it. What things do we think are so universally known morally that we do put a limit on religious liberty on some of those things?
You know, that's a good point. Oh, did you have something
to add? Well, I just want to follow up. I think the juxtaposition of the two comments is very interesting because on the one hand, religious liberty includes liberty of conscience, that is, the right to believe what one believes without fear of coercion, and also a liberty of practice, which is the right to act on that conscience and so express my religious beliefs in my religious worship. And religious liberty covers both of those notions, both of those ideas.
And I think, too, the use of the language is very important because we're talking about religious liberty, not religious libertinism or religious autonomy. Just because you're religious doesn't give you the right to do or say anything just because it's cloaked in a religious belief. There are times no one believes, or everyone believes that the Aztecs were being very authentic and convictional when they were participating in child murders. But the state recognizes that there's a vested interest, there's a general applicable interest in preventing murder universally, not just because some people are religious, some people are not. And so there are laws that would step in and say, no, we can't cross these particular lines.
That's right. And, you know, there's something that I would add as somebody who has studied all of this as well, is that one of the things that we did a good bit, at least kind of in the 20th century, was to extend this logic of accommodation, mm-hmm. right? That if someone had a really sincere problem with some statute or law or the way it's implemented, that the state might then extend some accommodation to them, right? And so, you know, what might be looked for in the case of something like the HHS mandate, some sort of accommodation, and so far that has not really been extended. Okay, to the question that I think that I had something sort of from all three of you, I've kind of phrased it this way. American Christians may be on the verge of a period of at least regulatory or administrative persecution. So not to suggest the sort of things we read about in the Voice of the Martyrs letter, but certainly significant limitations and intrusions. It will be increasingly difficult to gain protection for conscientious objections. It will also be more challenging to run institutions such as this one. Whole fields of endeavor may be closed off. But some will say, so what? Why would you insist on your rights? You are a Christian. Be happy to suffer wrong. Is yours not a religion of martyrdom? You know, why would you balk at these intrusions? What do you say to that? Is this quest for religious liberty misguided? Is this something is this a case we should not be pursuing?
Yes. I'll take a stab at that one first. I think we fail to connect religious liberty to the gospel. And we don't hold these positions just to hold them statically and in a vacuum. We hold positions because we believe that they're actually oriented towards a particular end, and that end is Christ. And so we have a vested interest in telling the truth. We are truth tellers by nature as Christians. And so when we're confronted with laws that impede our ability to tell the truth, it's not just harming ourselves, it's harming our neighbor, because we are being unable to tell our neighbor what we believe is true about human nature, true about eternal destiny, true about the nature and character of God. And so I understand that we should be careful in how we use the language of rights. We are someone who gave up his rights to go to the cross. That's the heart of the gospel itself right there. But we have to recognize at the same time that we are compelled to tell the truth. And whenever an obstacle gets in the way of the truth, there's a natural clash right there.
Either one of the other two.
Yeah, I think we said it in another way earlier, and that is that we're not talking about protecting religious liberty for Christians or protecting religious liberty for Baptists or protecting religious liberty for Mormons. We're talking about protecting religious liberty for human beings. And Ripley does not have liberty of conscience. And I know that because Dr. Watson feels perfectly free to coerce Ripley to do certain things that Ripley might or might not prefer to do. But that's not the case for, well, he actually might do that in the classroom too, but not in the same way. Not in the same way. Because human beings made in God's image, that's the theological grounding for our affirmation, human beings made in God's image ought not be coerced in their conscience or their practice in these ways, at least the ways that we're talking about. And so I agree with my colleague here exactly that neighbor love, then, from a Christian perspective, neighbor love love compels us to try to protect others. I mean, the Father Tertullian said that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church, and that is true, the seedbed of the church, that's true. And it could well be that the martyrdom of Christians will lead to great revival. But it's one thing for me to agree and to commit myself to martyrdom for the sake of the gospel. It's another thing for me to commit you to that. You should be free to exercise your conscience. And I should be free to die for my conscience if necessary.
Yeah, all my students are there voluntarily. So in that sense, if there's
true.
Any...
You're right.
But fair enough. I guess I'd say a couple things. One... I would echo this notion that it should not be just about our rights. It's not just about us. It is about what, you know, it's something that's important just in being human. And we believe that the gospel is powerful enough, not in our own thinking about why wouldn't we want to coerce people to believe what we believe. But we believe the gospel is powerful enough to handle itself in the public square without state support. We think, you know, Jesus did not call for that when he was here. The gospel is winsome enough to stand on its own strength in the public square. And so we want to defend everyone's right, their conscious right, to think about these things and to receive ideas and engage in this sort of thinking without having to have pressure put on them. The other thing I would say is sometimes religious freedom gets talked about as freedom of worship. And that's been an unfortunate phrase that's been used in the last few years sometimes to define this. And actually, that's not quite right. It's more than just the right to come to church, right? And I want to actually offer a quote here from someone in my attempt to be bipartisan. Our faith journey isn't just about showing up on Sunday for a good sermon and good music and a good meal. It's about what we do Monday through Saturday as well. That's from the First Lady Michelle Obama, right? Freedom of religion is freedom to live out your religion. And so when we advocate to protect that, we not only are protecting our own rights to come to church, for protecting the things that we do out in the public square. And those are the sorts of things that have been most endangered lately. Let me give you two quick examples. One, Catholic Charities does a lot of great work in trying to do pure religion, as James talks about, by looking after orphans and widows. And in the state of Massachusetts, they were one of the leading, if not the leading, agency that would take orphans and put them in good homes, because they also believe that marriage is between a man and a woman. Out of conscience, out of their conviction, Christian convictions, they will not put them in same-sex households. The state of Massachusetts has now said that you have to do that, and Catholic Charities has shut down their adoption. So there are less kids being put in homes through Catholic Charities because of the state's, I think, enforcement of that. Another example, this is an international example, the Organization of the Islamic Conference, which is a group of 56 mainly Muslim countries, has been attempting to make it a matter of international law that, on some interpretation, criticism of Islam would be illegal, right? Certain understood ways of criticizing Islam would be illegal, which would make the jobs of missionaries and dissidents and folks who aren't Muslims or might want to convert to Christianity much more difficult across the board. So when we advocate for religious freedom, we're not just advocating for our rights or Chick-fil-A, though those things are important, we're also advocating for the goods and the good things that people are doing in acting out their religion out in the public square and across the world.
You know, one thing I'd like to add to that, sometimes the language that I have found useful in this regard is the idea of a God and Caesar crisis, right? Caesar being the state. We don't want to put people in a crisis over their obligations to God and their obligations as citizens. That is a very bad place to be, right? You know, you would really struggle in your conscience. And this gets to the language that John Stuart found so perplexing, right? The idea that there could be certain obligations that you have that are higher obligations than even the state, then you run the risk of making a citizen an enemy of the state. And that's exactly what we don't want, right? You know, we want to work in tandem. We want a system where the church and the state are essentially friends and partners, and where the church calls the state to be the state, you know, to do what it is ordained by God to do. Okay. I want to ask a question that's relevant to college campuses especially. We have, over the past few years, I became a Christian through the ministry of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship on the campus of Florida State University. And during the last several years, we have seen InterVarsity and maybe other campus ministries being kicked off campus by various universities. Would you like to comment on that? And especially as regards, we see it happening at state schools and private schools. Do you see a difference in those two things?
Well, one difference is a private school has every right to define itself how it chooses to do so. And we at Union, obviously, this would be very important to us in maintaining and perpetuating our Baptist and evangelical identity. It's very important that we can make decisions as a university that reflects that. And so in that sense, if a more secular university chooses to define itself in a particular way that is hostile to Christianity, on a legal sense, of course, they have every right to do it. That's their conscience right? And we can say that's your right, and then we can choose accordingly with our educational choices. With a state university, then it gets much more complex, because a public university, a state university, is meant to serve the public, and Christians are an important part of the public. And so I would hope we would, whether it was Christians or Jews or Muslims or any kind of group that's being shut out, right, of a public university, again, our call is to speak up for what we think is right, not only for our own sake, but for the sake of any group that's part of the public, particularly given that those state universities are funded and supported by the taxes of everyone. So I think that at least that's one distinction that I think can be drawn between the private and the public. I do also think it's an increasing, or it's a marker of the increasing secularity or hostility to faith that our culture is manifesting.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Can I add to that?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think I think also we ought to be able to call on those public institutions to be fair and just in their their actions, and not to single out one religious group over another. In fact, not even to single out a religious group over an ideologically driven irreligious group. That is to say, if it's a group that meets to express its belief in these kind of profound identity questions that we have, then every group should be expelled from, if you will, that public space, not just one. And I think the dynamic that's going on here is that people are less and less understanding religion. And in our case, Christianity, not just as a deeply held belief, but as part of our very identity. In other words, I think that there's still within the culture, and increasingly so, I think there's a view of religion as a preference. You choose your religion the way you choose the coat that you wear each morning. And some days I'll wear this coat, or some days I'll wear that coat, and you choose religion that way. And people who do not have religious faith have a very hard time understanding how important religion is in our very identity. And sometimes they have a problem understanding that because we have displayed our own form of kind of schizophrenia or compartmentalism where we haven't acted as if our faith is part of our very identity.
Yeah, I think that's right. Andrew, do you have something?
A couple comments. In those situations like at Vanderbilt where that's happened, it's bad. B, we should always keep a proper context in mind about ourselves to recognize that we're not being murdered. We can still go off campus to worship. And then C, recognize that there is legitimate anti-Christian sentiment. Anti-Christian bigotry, you could even call it that. I don't want to leave any of you disillusioned or unhappy or sad, but the way that culture is going in one direction, Christian ethics goes, especially Christian sexual ethics, increasingly going in the opposite direction. I don't know of a happy resolution where we can all peaceably coexist. What I think we're seeing right now is the true freakishness of Christian sexual ethics actually being displayed. So in one sense, yes, we bemoan and regret the loss of common culture, a common sexual culture. But on the other end, we have an opportunity as Christians, in whatever context we are, even when we're being kicked off college campuses, to do so in a way that's not angry, we're not protesting, but we're simply saying, fine, Jesus is Lord, we'll move on, we think you're wrong, we'll even talk to our legislators. But Jesus is Lord.
Yeah. Just for clarity, would you explain the freakishness of Christian sexual ethics? I don't want us to be misunderstood.
Sure. So let me say, the freakishness of Christian sexual ethics is also the beauty and purity of Christian sexual ethics. The freakishness is seen against the backdrop of today's sexual orthodoxy. Christianity looks freakish. It looks strange. It looks foreign because we're still this band of happy warriors that insists that marriage ought to exist between a married man and a married woman. That we think
and married to one another.
And married to one another, yeah. Exactly. So yeah, I use freakishness in the absolute best sense of the term. That out of this freakishness, actually Western civilization kind of took root from it and really flourished. I've heard some people say that one of the best gifts Christianity gave Western civilization was the idea of covenantal monogamy in the sense that it stabilized society, provides adult enrichment, but ultimately it provides childhood protection.
Yeah, very good. You have one more thing?
Just add something on this real quick. We see this, we're talking about politics, and we're talking about government. We also see this just in culture, right? So one area where you see this, and I hope this is all right, I guess the camera's rolling, but in weddings now, I've been to several weddings with friends, and weddings have changed in terms of what happens with the reception and stuff afterwards, right? You'll see a lot of weddings. You go to weddings, particularly when I was living in a more less Bible-belty type area, where the couple stays for hours after the ceremony, and they'll meet the next day for brunch. This is the weekend where all their friends are here. They never have a chance to have this many people all in one place at the same time, right? The way we do weddings has changed. Well, why is it then that many Christian weddings, the bride and groom Well, they'll say hello, they'll eat the cake, they'll dance, and they're out of there, right? What's the difference? Well, the culture has changed such that for the Christian couple, they've waited, right? Not to be too blunt about it, but there's something going on. They want to go be a couple. Whereas our culture, the standard now is, well, the wedding's a special day, but there's really nothing new happening, right? Which is to say that our sexual ethics culturally has drifted a great deal. It's also to say that, you know, we can talk about the gay marriage thing, it's really important, but the heterosexual sex stuff, that ship sailed long, even before the gay marriage thing started, and that's actually, the gay marriage is the fruit of that. So when we pay attention to this, we also need to realize that your lives, our lives will look different culturally as well as politically, legally. How we make decisions, what we do, we're going to start standing out and looking freakish as compared to what the norm is for our national culture. So.
Okay. you know, Dr. Mitchell, we have a lot of students here who are pre-med, who are nursing, maybe even some pharmacy folks here. So Union has a lot of students who will enter the healthcare field one way or the other, you know, future doctors. What's going to happen? You know, what's the lay of the land out there? You know, as your specialty is bioethics, what's the lay of the land? What kind of career are they entering into? What kind of protections do they have for their consciences, you know, and sort of the choices that they would make and not make?
Well, it's a great question because it is a constantly changing context where the encroachments on the rights of healthcare workers is happening more and more every day. Whether it's talking about a physician who will not, or a medical student who will not participate in abortions even as part of the learning of medicine, or whether it's a pharmacist who will not distribute Plan B or another abortifacient drug. Increasingly, both students and professionals are being pressured to violate their consciences. And so I don't know what it's going to look like by the time our students graduate, but I know enough about the trajectory that we're going and the speed that we're going that it's going to be more difficult than it is today. For the foreseeable future. And I think that's a tragedy, not just for those who have been called to the profession, but I think it's a tragedy for those who, like me, are a patient. And I want a physician who has the virtues of that have traditionally underwritten medicine. I want a doctor who is not going to want to dispatch my life early. And a doctor who's going to respect the sanctity of life at the beginning of life. I want that kind of physician. And it may be increasingly difficult in the short-term future, at least, to find that kind of physician, unless you're willing to go outside the mainstream system and go to some kind of boutique medicine where you and your physician agree on certain values and make some kind of arrangements outside whatever the payment system ends up being.
Okay. One of the things, maybe we don't have time for another full question. One of the things I would like to leave you with is that, you know, Mr. Walker adverted to this loss of a common culture, right? And somebody like Francis Schaeffer might have said, you know, we've lost the Christian consensus that our society has. But it's important to remember, all of you, especially at a Baptist university, and Dr. Mitchell referred to this, we have the resources within our own tradition to really appreciate religious liberty and to understand what it is to advocate for religious liberty. We've been through a long time where we've had kind of a free ride, right? A confident, culturally dominant Christianity. I grew up in an Alabama town where we had prayer in my public school well after the Supreme Court had ruled otherwise, you know, and nobody questioned that. And now we're entering into a different sort of period. But you know what? The Christian church, and indeed Baptists, have not always been dominant, will not always. There will be another time when we will ascend, I think, and enjoy better times, but this is not that time. But we need to look back to the resources we have to battle for the liberty that is needed in times like these. Now, with that, I have been told I was speaking at another university one time, so it wasn't this one. But I was speaking at chapel, and the dean of chapel told me, the spirit can be moving. The heavens may be falling down upon the auditorium, and you will get those kids out of there at 10:45. And so the clock is about to turn. I'd ask you to thank our speakers, and then you may be dismissed. Thank you.